Cybersecurity is a major challenge for everyone, companies and individuals alike. But it can be a particularly big challenge for those in the financial industry. After all, it's not just firm data at risk. It can also be customers' data and customers' life savings at stake. Today, we have three members of FINRA's member supervision team with us to discuss a new report on effective cybersecurity practices for FINRA member firms. Welcome to FINRA Unscripted from New York. I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. I'm pleased to welcome to the show today three individuals from our member supervision team. We have Steve Polanski, a senior director in the Shared Services Group. We've got Dave Kelly, a surveillance director out of our Kansas City office. And we got Yolanda Trotman, an examination director in the Regulatory Review Group in New York. So Steve, Dave, and Yolanda are here with us today to help detail what's in FINRA's new recently released report on cybersecurity effective practices. To start, Steve, I just wanted to ask, what is the new report? How is it different from our examination findings report, which was also recently released? And how is it also different from the 2015 report on cybersecurity practices?
Let me start with the latter, with the report on cybersecurity practices. That was our first larger report in this area, and this report essentially supplements that report. It doesn't replace it. Rather, it adds greater depth in some selected areas. That first report was really intended to help firms develop an overall cybersecurity program. So it addressed issues such as cybersecurity governance, risk assessment, vendor management, the broad range of topics that you'd need to put together a comprehensive program. The report we're talking about today really focuses on five specific areas that, based on what we've seen in the examination program and other interactions with firms, we've identified as areas that firms may need some additional help with or where information would be useful. It addresses things like phishing, which is one of the principal risks that firms face, branch controls, mobile device controls, insider threats, and pen testing. So if a firm wants to learn more about how to address those areas specifically, this report, we hope, will be helpful. And it's similar in some respects to the exam findings report because it's based on what we're seeing through our exam program. So it's essentially an exam findings report focused on cybersecurity.
So cybersecurity is that important that it deserved its own document separate from the exam findings report?
We thought so, and I'd certainly welcome Dave and Yolanda's comments, but I know in some of the interactions that I've had with firms, they frequently identify it as the most significant risk that they face.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Firms that we've talked to rate cyber as one of their top three or four risks that they talk about as an organization. And these five areas that we're talking about today, they all are areas that firms tend to struggle with more than some of the other areas.
And I think firms also welcome the opportunity to hear the type of effective practices that other firms are using as a benchmark to compare their program to other firms' programs across the industry.
One other thing I wanted to add is that the practices that we identify in this report, as I mentioned, are things that we've seen in place at a number of firms. But we're not saying in this report that any particular firm has to implement any or all of these practices. These are simply observations that we think can help firms think about their cybersecurity programs, but we're not saying that firms have to have these specific measures in place.
So let's dig into some of those effective practices. Let's start with branch office controls. Dave, who should really look at this section and what should they take away from it?
Really, it's any firm that has branches. If you have a location in your firm that's away from your home office, then you've got a branch office risk from cybersecurity. And there's a lot of different types of branches out there. If you're a firm with independent contractor model, you have different risks for those firms.
So what are some of the unique risks under this model, the independent contractor model?
In the independent contractor model, usually those branches are buying their own equipment, they're installing their own software, and they're putting all their own controls in place. The home office usually doesn't have a whole lot to do with what's going on at those branch locations. But those branch locations usually have data also that they're trying to protect. So the home office doesn't really have a whole lot of say or control over how that branch is protecting that data.
So what can a firm do to enhance security at these branch locations?
Well, there's several things that we're seeing at some firms to help protect branches and the data at those locations. The first thing is we're seeing a lot of firms putting together a policy just for branches as to what branches should be thinking about, what controls should a branch be putting together. And this could be anything from the types of software to have, where they store data, what passwords look like. For instance, how long is a password? How is it put together? What vendors can they use? If they're going to use a cloud service, what type of cloud service can they use? What type of training should they have for those branch locations? So there's a lot of things like that that the firms really need to think about and get that policy put together.
Makes sense. It's hard to ensure standards are up to code if you don't have standards in place.
Exactly right.
One thing I noticed in the report was a recommendation for an asset inventory. What is it and why is it a good idea?
Well, an asset inventory is basically just a list of the hardware, software, and data and vendors that a firm or a branch uses. And that will give them a good understanding of what kind of controls they need to have in place once they understand what assets they have.
And this seems like it's an area that might not just involve cybersecurity, but also physical assets as well. Is that right?
Oh, exactly right. You know, physical security is a big part of any firm's cybersecurity program. You just can't leave your front door open. So you've got to have a way to protect that data and protect those assets so somebody can't come in and steal it.
And what kind of technical controls might a firm put in place at branches?
There's a lot of different things, and it really depends on the type of work that's done at that branch. But encryption is one of the first things we always like to see. The hard drives of any computer or any server at that branch should be encrypted. There always should be some sort of virus protection in place. Passwords, I mentioned that before, but passwords, they need to have a good process for what the password looks like, how long it is, what kind of characters are involved there. If you have a wireless network, which most branch locations have, are they protecting that wireless network or is it just out there for anybody to get access to? And then I mentioned vendors. How are they using vendors? What kind of controls do they have over those vendors? And are they requiring those vendors to comply with the policies and procedures that the firm already has in place?
At the end of the day, even if a firm has a great policy in place and really strong technical controls, it won't really matter if the firm's not actually making sure the branches are following it. So what kind of best practices do you see in actually reviewing these programs?
It's kind of a changing area. All firms have to have branch exams in place. So they're going to branches at least every 3 years. Some branches they go to every year. So a cybersecurity section of that branch exam should be in place. But there's also some automated tools now that are popping up out there that firms are using. And with these automated tools, the home office can be checking on almost a daily basis to verify that encryption is in place and you've got virus protection in place. And what kind of data possibly is being stored on that PC or even that server. So those are good things. Other firms are starting to provide more IT support to the branch office locations, and that's a good thing. Or maybe they're signing up a outside vendor to provide that IT support to the branch locations. And that helps those branches understand really what type of controls they need to have in place and making sure that they are in place. And one last thing that we're starting to see, which is a good thing, I mentioned the policy for the branches before. We're starting to see a lot of firms requiring the reps at the branch location certify on an annual basis that they are following those controls in that report.
All good information to know. I wanted to move on, Steve, to phishing. It seems like a perennial issue. Is there anything new here, or is it just still that big of a risk that you have to mention it in the report?
I think it's one of the most significant risks that we see in the cybersecurity area because essentially it affects any firm that has humans working there, which is, as far as I know, all of our firms. And it's an area where we see continual problems and breaches of customer information or funds transfers that take place that either are directly a result of the phishing attack or sort of an indirect result of a phishing attack that has taken place perhaps on a customer.
So it's not just phishing they have to worry about for their own employees, but customers as well?
I think that's another angle, yes, because the attackers can use phishing attacks to gain access to customers' accounts and then use the customers' accounts to try and affect whatever their objective is, whether it's transferring funds or, I guess it's primarily transferring funds.
But stealing information about that customer, yes. Yep.
So what are some of the best practices for spotting or limiting the risk of a phishing attack?
So there are some technical controls that firms can put in place in terms of email filtering, but it really comes down most fundamentally to training your employees and building awareness among your employees about the hallmarks of a phishing attack. And in the report, we go into greater detail on this, but there are things that people should be looking at. For example, possible misspellings of names or websites of the purported attacker. If it's, say, something from Dave Kelly to me, and Dave Kelly spells his last name K-E-L-L-E-Y, and I get an email where the return address is K-E-L-L-Y, you need to be attentive to these sort of nuances in both website addresses, email addresses, and where you see differences, that should set off alarm bells. There can be misspellings, odd grammar sometimes in phishing emails. They can be requests to provide sensitive information that would seem unusual. There can be requests to do things like transfer funds that can seem unusual. So there are a range of things that people need to be attentive to, and firms can certainly provide training to help them with this.
Are these firms just training their employees, or do they also let customers know as well that they would never ask for certain information in any email?
I think we're starting to see more and more firms train their customers also. They're putting information out there on websites, talking about what the customer needs to be thinking about as they're using their own credentials and logging into their systems.
And there's a FINRA investor alert, phishing and other identity theft scams, don't take the bait, on our website. So that's another resource for investors or that firms can use to refer their customers to.
Great. We'll add a link to that in our show notes. So, Steve, what kind of process controls can a firm put in place when it comes to customer transfer requests?
So what we've seen firms do in response to phishing attacks where the customer or somebody in the firm is potentially asking a firm employee to do something, like a customer asking a rep to transfer money, in that particular case, we've seen firms implement verification policies, say if the transfer request is above a certain amount of money or potentially to a problematic region, where the firm may contact the customer directly by phone to confirm that the request is actually from the customer. Or similarly, if the firm were subject to a whaling attack, if, say, the CFO sends an instruction to wire money to an unusual location, then perhaps the person who received the instruction would contact the CFO's office to verify that that is, in fact, a legitimate transfer request.
So we've seen that most firms have those policies and procedures in place. What happens in most cases is those policies break down. So the person at the firm or the rep feel like they're helping out that customer, so they don't do that verification. And so then the money goes out when it shouldn't.
So moving on to insider threats, maybe we can start with who counts as an insider?
So similar to phishing, insider threats are basically individuals. And insiders are individuals who currently have or have previously had authorized access to firm systems and data because of their job function or their role. These individuals can be full-time or part-time employees, contract or temporary employees, consultants, and interns. Insiders may also include employees or contractors of third-party vendors, as well as subcontractors and developers who have backdoor access to the firm's systems.
That's a lot of people you have to keep in mind. The report also talks about malicious behavior versus inadvertent error. What's the difference and what's the bigger risk?
So malicious behavior is an insider who intentionally misuses their access to information for personal gain, such as a bad actor who plans to sell customer account information in the dark web, or an insider who's harvesting data related to a client's trading strategies, which they may use for sale at a later date, or to trade against for financial gain. So I think the malicious behavior is obviously the higher risk behavior because it's behavior that can have a significant impact on a firm. Inadvertent behavior is an insider whose unintentional actions may result in a security breach, such as a registered representative who loses their laptop or storage media with unencrypted customer PII information.
So that's why, as Dave mentioned, with the branch controls, you also need to be making sure there's encryption on those laptops.
It all ties together, yes.
So what makes for an effective insider risk program?
A few things. First and foremost, executive leadership and management support is very important. Having technical controls related to a firm's identity and access management policy is also very important, particularly with respect to privileged users who have heightened access to firm systems. With an identity access management program, it's important to make sure that individuals' access to firm systems are aligned with their job function or role.
As we're out there doing exams and talking to firms, we really like to see firms doing this type of check at least annually, but a lot of firms are doing it more maybe every 6 months. They're doing a review of all the access just to verify who has access to what.
Training for all persons that meet the definition of an insider is also very important. Also, processes to identify potentially abnormal user behavior in the firm's network, as well as maintaining a complete asset inventory, which Dave talked about earlier, is a key element of an effective insider risk program.
Obviously, someone needs to be managing your servers and your network, so some privileged users have to exist. What can firms do to improve controls on those privileged users?
So some effective practices would be to assign privileged users to special administrative groups and review their system and network use for unapproved activities. Also requiring multi-factor authentication for privileged user logins at all times, as well as segregation of privileged user access. So you may have some privileged users that are responsible for deployment of systems. You want those individuals' access to be different from privileged users who maybe are involved with maintenance or the change management process.
So one other thing I'll ask on the insider threats area is something I had never heard of before, SIEM tools. Can you explain what those are and how they can help?
Okay, so SIEM, which stands for Security Information and Event Management, are
a mouthful.
Yes, it is a mouthful. They are software products and services that provide real-time analysis of security alerts that are generated by applications and also network hardware. And SIEM tools collect, aggregate, and correlate log information from numerous sources within the firm's systems and network, some of which include firewalls, intrusion detection and prevention systems, servers, as well as network devices. We've also seen trends recently in the use of behavioral analytics with respect to doing this type of analysis, which include a learning element that allows the tool over time to detect privileged user irregular patterns as well as abnormal behaviors and flag the activity for further review.
Sounds like an interesting development. Dave, another section of the report was penetration testing or pen testing. What is pen testing and why is it important for a firm to have that in place?
So penetration testing or pen testing is testing that you do or have somebody do from the outside of the organization to simulate what a hacker would do. So say you want somebody to see if they can break into your system. There's three different types of testing that's done. The first type is white box testing, which is where you're telling somebody a little bit of information about your system. So for instance, the IP addresses, or giving them access to a certain server so that you may be giving them the username and password for a server and see where they can get once they get that information.
For example, maybe something someone might have acquired from the firm through a phishing email?
Exactly right. So you're really testing to see what they can get to, how far they can get, and do you have good controls to block that once they get there? The next one is black box testing, and that's where you give them nothing. So you just say, hey, go find us out there on the web and see what you can find, see what you can do, how far you can get. And then there's the gray in the middle where you give them a little bit of information. And based on that information you give them, you may give them, for instance, the IP address for a particular server and see what they can do based on that. You're doing different types of tests based on the risk that you've identified for your firm. So you're usually doing these pen testing on servers that are out there on the internet someplace, so where there's some risk to the firm. A great example would be if you have a firm that has online trading for their customers. You know, so they have a lot of servers out there on the web. So you want to see if somebody can break into those servers some other way.
And why is it necessary to do this pen testing, and do all firms need it?
I think any firm that has servers or anything, any equipment out there accessible over the web, it's a great way to test the controls of your systems. So I think those firms should be doing some sort of penetration testing on an ongoing basis. We like to see firms do that at least annually, but if it's a high-risk system, so for instance, that online trading system, you may be wanting to do the penetration testing on a more often basis. And especially if you're doing lots of changes to that system, you want to make sure you're not putting a new risk out there for your firm.
So the fifth and final item in the new report is mobile devices. We all have them, so I can understand why this is an important item for firms to look at. Is any type of firm more at risk, Yolanda, or is this truly a universal thing?
Although all firms offering mobile access are at risk, we have seen firms with large numbers of retail customers, as well as a large branch network, have greater exposure to cyber risk and require more rigorous controls to protect both customer and firm information. Also, firms with financial advisors who are independent contractors elevates the cyber risk, as the independent contractors typically use personal technology to conduct business with customers.
So what can a firm do to develop sound practices for all those group employees, consultants, contractors, and retail clients?
So first and foremost, you have to have or develop policies and procedures, as well as providing training to address obligations to protect customer and firm information. A lot of firms are using bring your own device policies. To the extent possible, prohibit the use of personal devices for firm business. So don't allow email, texting, and any other type of messaging on personal devices. Also, include reviews of mobile device security controls as part of branch office inspections. That is really important. And also ensure compliance and technology support staff are knowledgeable in mobile and cybersecurity risks.
And I'm sure the firms that have retail customer apps that their customers can download have their own concerns. What do they need to keep in mind?
So those firms definitely need to keep in mind providing training to their customers, having disclosures on their websites about the risks associated with downloading that information, and also have systems and tools in place to identify when information that is being downloaded is at risk to the firm's technology infrastructure.
I think another key part of that is every time they're doing changes to that mobile application that customers are using, that they're doing an adequate amount of testing from a security standpoint. Data security really needs to be involved in the development of any applications that are out there and doing that testing on an ongoing basis.
Well, as our listeners can tell, there's a lot of information in this report. So we will include a link to it in our show notes if you want to follow up and dig in on any of these five items. Steve, Dave, Yolanda, really appreciate you joining us today to talk us through some of this really interesting stuff. That's it for today's episode, and that's actually it for our podcast for 2018. So from New York, I'm your host, Caitlin Kiernan. We wish you all a safe, pleasant, and warm holiday season, and we'll hope you'll join us again in the new year.
Please note, FINRA podcasts are the sole property of FINRA, and the information provided is for informational and educational purposes only. The content of the podcast does not constitute any FINRA rule or amendment or interpretation to such rules. Compliance with any recommended conduct presented does not mean that a firm or person has complied with the full extent of their obligations under FINRA rules, the rules of any other SRO, or securities laws. This podcast is provided as is. FINRA and its affiliates are not responsible for any human or mechanical errors or omissions. Parties may not reproduce these podcasts in any form or reference them in any publication without the express written consent of FINRA.